Welcome to the Joe Cohen Show. Join me as I share my experience with biohacking and invite top health experts to explore the latest technology, supplements, research, and resources for optimizing your body and brain.
This clip is from the first episode of the season with Dr. Oz Garcia, titled Improve Your Mood, Unlock Happiness, and Reduce Pain.
I'm curious, what's your favorite immediate hack for dealing with an oncoming cold? Let's say you're getting a sore throat, your chest is beginning to fill up a little bit. I'm curious.
Yeah. So I'm also curious of what you think. And I would say that
based on the
amino acid testing and a lot of the blood testing I did, I was able to see what happens when you get sick a few times.
Serious.
Yeah. So that was great. Tell me some of the things you do, and then we can go back and forth.
The immediate thing is to go straight to heat. So I'm going to do an extreme hot bath. I learned this actually from different Russian athletes when we had our office in Moscow. And believe it or not, after East Germany collapsed, a lot of information came out about how they would train their athletes and make super freaks out of them, how they were able to hide a lot of the ways that they treated these athletes to become super athletes. But they would travel with stainless steel tubs and bring the water to like slightly above boiling and throw the athlete in. But piece by piece, sit in the edge of the tub, produce extreme heat to the extremities, their feet, then get in up to your hips, then get in up to your neck. And if you do that early enough, it seems to trigger a hyper response from the immune system tremendously right away. So I'll do a variant of that, which is very simple. I run my tub extremely hot, as hot as I can possibly take it, get in extremely slowly. I'm also putting in there eucalyptus. I'm putting in baking soda. I'm putting in hydrogen peroxide. And I'm going to soak for about 20 minutes. So heat makes a tremendous difference in that regard. And I would say that's a very simple hack. Then if I'm going to scale it, I'm going to use probably different peptides that have massive impact on the immune system immediately. So I'm going to use thymosin. I'm going to use thymulin. I'll probably use KPV. And I'll use these selectively throughout the day. Then orally, of course, I'm just going to bombard myself with everything from probiotics all the way through to going to my clinic and doing some pretty neat IVs. So that's going to be like 20 grams of vitamin C, along with intravenous NAC, glutathione, injectable licorice, and that's DGL. So we pretty much have that compound of methylene blue. And I'd say within 24 hours, I've just turned the whole thing around. So that's not something everybody can do, but that's a look at behind the curtains of what I'm going to do for myself. And we're going to set that up for our clients too, those that actually know that this is a path to dealing with what they need to pretty quickly, right? And if we're getting clients that are coming off planes that God knows what they picked up on a flight, this is like the more elite way that you're going to deal with. Are you coming down with something? You just can't afford to be sick.
I love it. I love it. It's everything that I don't do, but I love it.
Well, when you're in New York, it's a treat.
No, I think it's great. I would like to try to incorporate. So I'm assuming that I'll get sick at some point in the future. And I'm always looking for new hacks to see. And so I think I've been building on some more of the basics. Some of the things I've done simply don't work or don't work enough to notice the difference. So that's something. Would you say that the sauna would be as good as that very hot bath, or it's not going to be?
Yeah, but I won't use an infrared. I'll use a stone sauna. I'll throw water on the stones. That vapor is going to make all the difference. Very different than doing a steam bath.
Okay. So the sauna doesn't help me that much. Like, I was doing a sauna a lot.
And remember, I'm qualifying it. It's not my favorite. I think an immersion into hot water really pays.
That's why I'm asking if it's a different. I haven't done the immersion into hot water. The sauna, it could help, by the way. I don't think it helps me enough that I would use it as part of my protocol.
You can also get slightly immunosuppressed by a sauna.
Correct. That's exactly what I was about to say. So it also has immunosuppressive properties, in which case, like, maybe directly it's heating you up and it's good in certain ways. And then, but it also is suppressing the immune system in other ways. So I don't know. I'm a little, but do you think the bath, the warm bath, the hot bath is different?
I never would have believed it. But again, since we had an off, we were working with some of the world's top athletes, both former East German athletes and certainly Russian. And they had a lot of old school stuff that still panned out remarkably well. And you got to remember that since they were cut off from the West after the Second World War in terms of a lot of what they could have taken advantage of from antibiotics and so on, they were actually compelled to develop whole new technologies. Most of the peptides that are used in the West were developed originally in Russia. And I would say a lot of the nootropics that we use today, especially piracetam and all the different kinds of racetams that there are, were developed in the former Eastern Europe bloc. So it's important to note that they had to come up with their kind of medicine. It turned out to work remarkably well. Anytime that we'd be working in Moscow, I would be like in a candy store if I went into a drugstore. It was like, what is this stuff? Their herbal remedies were beyond belief too. But what they also had were the traditional Russian bathhouses. And there you would go, if I was jet lagged, I would go, and I do that in New York. I love the old Russian bathhouses in New York, where you're going to sweat for quite a while, but they're throwing a lot of water on the stones. And then you could go do a cold plunge. It could be immunosuppressive, but typically if you do that right at the beginning, you just go home, go to sleep, and you just may wind up feeling a lot better.
That's interesting. Okay. So I'm wondering also how much of the bath plus all the other things you're putting in it also are impacted.
Oh, they turn out to make a huge difference.
Okay. Are you able to tell, let's say, which things had a big difference? Meaning at certain points, I try the kitchen sink approach. And then at those points, you can't really tell what's working, what's not. Then over time, I try one thing at a time. Like getting sick, it takes a lot longer because you don't get sick every day. So it's like it does take a lot longer to see how your immune system is reacting. And also there's certain symptoms like that I can tell if my immune system is better. Just for example, I used to, if I didn't get like 7-8 hours of sleep, I would wake up with a runny nose a little bit, right? I just felt my immune system was weaker.
I would say using a wearable like Aura is, if I notice my body temperature is up by about a degree or more, I know that I'm headed for trouble. And more often than not, just that particular indicator is enough. I'm a bit more tired. I've gotten my 8 hours of sleep, but my body temperature is up. And it's, oh, okay, that's an early predictor that you and I couldn't have used 10 years ago, maybe six years ago.
Yeah, that's also an interesting predictor as well. What else do you think is like a big factor?
Believe it or not, zinc on contact, like zinc lozenges, zinc picolinate lozenges are terrific. A lot of viruses are first going to start taking off in your throat, and you already know that. And I would say for studies that I'm sure you're well aware of, zinc on contact seems to have a rapid effect on turning around a viral infection that may be taken off in your throat.
This clip is from episode 8, a solo podcast from Joe, titled How to Optimize Your Methylation. Methylation has always been a huge topic in the health space, and so Joe wanted to create an episode to educate you, the listeners, on everything related to methylation, highlighting some real information about methylation, and then also putting a spotlight on a lot of the garbage that is usually floating around the internet.
There's a lot of information about methylation. I think a lot of it is garbage. And we're going to be talking about how to test whether you're an overmethylator, maybe an undermethylator, and what do you do about it? So if you're not methylating well enough, what do you do about it? And so we're going to go through the recommendations and everything you need to know about methylation. This is going to include a little bit about MTHFR, but it's not going to be mainly about MTHFR, just to have you understand that. So I'm going to share my screen for people who want to follow. And essentially, the basic test, there's a few tests that you can do to check methylation. One is a genetic test, and it could give you your predisposition to whether you're an undermethylator or not. And then you could do lab tests, which you can verify using a bunch of different lab markers. I'm going to share my screen now. So if you're using self-decode, which of course is the only test, the only genetic test that I recommend, you're basically going to search for methylation and you're going to come up with different reports related to methylation. This is the main one that's called methylation. You could see that I am lower in methylation and it gives you different information about methylation, gives you some charts. You could see methylation, there's a lot of genetic variants that are related to it, and you could see how if you're looking. Now, we're going to go to the lab tests that are relevant to methylation, and I recommend doing that before you really take any kind of treatment protocol or follow any recommendations. So there are some basic labs that I recommend checking for. There's some more advanced ones. For example, it's the SAM to SAH Sol ratio. That's, I'd say, a more advanced one. But the more basic ones that are pretty widely available is serum folate, homocysteine, serum B6, serum B12. So these are, serum B12 and serum folate are commonly tested by your doctor, and then homocysteine as well. You're usually going to request that, but they'll usually test that. And sometimes not, depending on your doctor. And then some slightly more advanced ones could be methionine and B6. So you need enough methionine in order to create SAMe. And B6 also helps as part of methylation in various ways, including lowering homocysteine. I'd say the single best one is looking at your homocysteine. And you could also look at your genetic result, which will give you some kind of indication as well. Sometimes you might be genetically fine with methylation, but you could still have high homocysteine because there's things that increase homocysteine that we will discuss. And so even if you're genetically okay, you could still need more methyl groups. Now, we have 28 recommendations for methylation, and I'm going to go through each one describing how they could help. And they're ordered based on the priority for my personal genetics. And the first one is going to be methylfolate. So you're going to see methylfolate is important for methylation. With B12, it helps convert homocysteine to methionine. And so it's quite an important nutrient for methylation. And you could see also that it says I have the MTHFR variant. I have an increased need for folate, which means that I'd want to get more folate in my diet. I also have a PEMT gene variant linked to high homocysteine levels and in people with reduced folate intake. So again, these two genetic variants actually make it more important for me to get adequate levels of folate and even a bit more folate. So I do supplement with methylfolate. And then there's vitamin B12. So if you're going to supplement with methylfolate, you need to take B12 as well. And they work together. In my case, it says I have a genetic variant MTRR that may be linked to impaired methylation and higher homocysteine levels. Vitamin B12 is essential for MTRR enzyme function. The effects of this variant on homocysteine may be stronger in people with low vitamin B12 levels. You could see the recommendations are also taking into account these genetic variations, and you could see more why these genetic variations are having an impact. Next up is trimethylglycine, also known as TMG or betaine. And this is something that you can take. So you can also look at the genetic variants here. There's a couple genetic variants that are related to it, PEMT, MTHFR again, but also a BHMT enzyme. And I have a BHMT enzyme that may be linked to impaired methylation, higher homocysteine, and people with this variant may benefit from increasing betaine intake. So that's another recommendation. And by the way, all of the recommendations that I mentioned here, I do myself. So I take I take vitamin B12 and I take betaine. The amount of methylfolate, I'll go through the dosing that I take personally, I take around 2 milligrams methylfolate, which is higher than most people need. I would generally recommend about 1 milligram, and I take about 0.5 milligram of B12 methylcobalamin, and I think that's a pretty decent dosage. And then I take about 3 to 4 grams of trimethylglycine, and that is enough. That's a pretty good amount. You don't generally want to take more than 4 grams a day long term. Then number 4 is limiting alcohol intake. So alcohol actually depletes a bunch of B vitamins, including B1, folate. It also depletes choline, so increases the risk of choline deficiency, and it can worsen your genetics by blocking MTR and PEMT. So it seems like I have 2 gene variants. One is PMT and MTHFD1 that is linked to choline deficiency. And these alcohol can potentially exacerbate the effects of these genetic variants. Next up, we have dietary choline. There's 2 really major sources of dietary choline. And the major sources of dietary choline are going to be liver and eggs. If you're not getting any of those foods, it's generally going to be hard to get enough dietary choline. Eggs and liver by far have the most choline out of any food. Beef liver has more. Chicken liver also has quite a lot. So choline is important because it converts to betaine, which is important as well. And if you're not getting enough choline, then you're not going to have enough betaine. And if you need more methyl groups, your body can be converting more choline into betaine, and then you'll be deficient in choline for other uses. So you want to make sure you're getting enough choline as well in your diet. I don't think you need to supplement with a choline if you have methylation issues. And it also depends on the individual. So what I do is I take a supplement and I'll measure my homocysteine levels to see if I'm in the normal range. And I keep doing that to make sure until I get in the normal range and increase the number of supplements I'm taking or increase the dosage until I get in the optimal range. And the optimal ranges for homocysteine are on the site and for all of the lab results. And so you could see for us, it's 5 to 9 and above.
This clip is from episode 9 with Michael Lustgarten, titled Biohacking Longevity, Navigating Lab Tests, Supplements, and Lifestyle for Optimal Aging. So in this episode, Joe and Michael explore the crucial role of different lab markers in longevity, what the optimal lab test ranges are for some of the important labs, and other factors that could potentially affect longevity and lifespan.
I find that really interesting that you don't take any supplements. That's like very unique in this field, right? Because you're really into anti-aging. You got your Conquer Aging shirt.
Or Dietry.
Okay.
Yeah.
And you don't take any supplements. Because what I find is that if I don't take any supplements, I have a bunch of lab markers that are not in the optimal range. And there's certain, I need to... Okay, do you believe in the true diagnostic test at all, for example? You were on that board. I take that
back. Oh, leaderboard.
Yeah. What was your number? Let's see. Do you remember?
Yeah. So they have 2 different leaderboards. One is most improved, and then the other is the absolute 6-month 3-test average. Here's the interesting story, which goes to supplementation. You know, I mentioned my NAD levels are low or relatively low. So yeah. I was taking 600 milligrams of nicotinic acid per day to try to boost mm-hmm. NAD. I tripled my NAD levels, but my Dunedin pace.
600 milligrams of what were you taking? Nicotinic acid?
Yeah. So I have 10 tests for true diagnostics since 2022. 8 of those tests are 0.82 or lower. 0.98 on the day, same day as the test, 600 milligrams of nicotinic acid. Which suggests
nicotinic acid increases your rate of aging.
Very high dose, because then I repeated the test with 60 milligrams of nicotinic acid. It raised NAD to 39 micromolar, not as high. And the epigenetic age on that day was like, Dunedin pace was like 0.8 or something reasonable in my normal range.
Okay.
It's very high dose. Now, the question, is it a high nicotinic acid dose or is it a high NAD dose? So I did that experiment. I took 2 grams of NMN per day, NAD, 60 micromolar, just like with high-dose nicotinic acid. I don't have those results yet back from True Diagnostic, but if they're 0.9 something, again, ridiculous, which is an outlier in my data, very high NAD could be bad for epigenetic aging.
Okay, that's very interesting. So you, why did you decide on 600 milligrams? Is that because you were, is it because you were checking your NAD levels and that's where it got optimized?
So there's a paper that shows that it's called Niacin Cures Systemic NAD Deficiency, RCT in people. I think they used a higher dose. It was like 1,000 milligrams of nicotinic acid. And I've actually used up to 3 grams in the past for lipoprotein A. So I was like, all right, 600, I don't know. Let's just see. And then once I saw the Dunedin pace, and it didn't affect glucose, which it's been shown to do in my case for that one test. But yeah, I cut the dose down, no flush. The flush on 600 milligrams per day is outrageous for me. So I'm happy to make that change. But now I'm actually trying to, I took nicotinic acid out, and I'm actually trying to increase NAD without messing up the Dunedin pace by increasing trigonelline in my diet, increasing dietary intake of that. I don't know if you've heard of trigonelline.
One second. Trigonelline, I heard of it. Yeah, no, it's on my radar, but I don't know. It's a metabolite, right? How do you also supplement with it?
No, diet. First diet.
Okay. What do you do within your diet to increase trigonelline? You're trying to increase trigonelline?
Yep. So trigonelline is methyl nicotinic acid. It's just the methyl group added to niacin, right? So chickpeas, coffee is a great source, but I'm not a coffee drinker. I have green tea every day. I just don't have the hydration space for more fluid. And I hate the idea of coffee breath, but chickpeas are a pretty good source of trigonelline. So I didn't have any, people have been on me for a long time. Why don't you have legumes in your diet? It's a pro longevity, blue zones, all this. And I'm like, look at my data. What's it going to, it hasn't, I don't have any room. So I took out barley and oats, which isn't only like 60 grams per day total. It's not a lot, but in making that shift, I can get about 20 milligrams of trigonelline per day from chickpeas, which doesn't seem like a lot, but consider that 60 milligrams of nicotinic acid per day increases NAD.
This is really interesting. So I took the Dunedin pace test twice.
Yep.
And the first time I took it, I was on high dose niacin. High dose. And I was also trying, I was doing it to get my LPA down and it didn't work. So I just stopped it. And it also messed up other labs like HbA1c. It messed up, it increased my liver enzymes a little bit. Things that are actually shown in the research, and it also lowered my thyroid hormone. So it was an experiment. And the reason I did the experiment is because I realized that I did a couple tests that indicated that I needed more niacin. And then I took niacin. I felt really great on it. And that was like 100, 200 milligrams, basically up to 500 milligrams. I feel really great on it. More than that, at some point, I don't know exactly what that point is yet. So that's what I have to figure out. Where is the turning point? Is it 200 milligrams? Is it 300, 400? My rule of thumb now is to keep it under 500 milligrams. And yeah, but I was taking at that point, the first test I was taking about 1300 milligrams. My Dunedin paste was, wait for it. 0.72. I was taking, I was probably taking about 250 milligrams of niacin. And my second result, I'm going to take the test again in February, but my second result came out as 0.63.
Nice. All right, wait, you had nicotinic acid for both, right?
Yeah, but one was higher dose niacin. And then I realized, I actually didn't realize what it was doing to my pace of aging, right? I wasn't taking it off. I was mainly doing it because there were certain labs I saw that I knew were actually, this is a side effect of niacin, and the benefits weren't as large as I had expected. Meaning there is a very big, there's a significant dose response curve. The more you take a little bit, all of a sudden you get a really good effect, and then you take too much, it just keeps going down from there. And that's just something I measured, which is why I do the pretty extensive lab testing.
This clip is from episode 11, and it's a solo pod titled A Practical Guide to Lab Tests for Optimal Health. So in this episode, Joe sheds light on the crucial role lab tests play in understanding our overall health. And he dives really deep into the realm of comprehensive testing and shares a bunch of insights on tons of essential lab markers that you need to take in order to really optimize your health.
DHEA sulfate, this is an interesting one. I don't think this is normally checked for, but I think it's actually quite an important test to check for. And you could see my history. So in this case, having a history is very important. I first checked it in 2015, April 2015, and I had a 275. And it wavers, right? It's gone down, it's gone up. My genetic predisposition is that I have lower levels of this. And you could see it tends to be on the lower end, right? It's on the lower end even when I'm supplementing with DHEA. And I didn't really understand fully why that is until recently. So DHEA converts into testosterone. And studies show that if you have higher levels, that has benefits on mortality. It's also an androgen. It's good for mood. So you could see like DHEA sulfate. What does it have to do with? It has to do with muscle mass. So genetically higher levels causally associated with reduced inflammation and improved muscle mass. Okay. Because it is an androgen. It's related to heart health. Now, low DHEAS may be associated with a higher risk of heart disease and mortality, especially in men, right? So again, every marker that you have is because of some reason. And you have to understand what that reason is. And you don't want to be have a higher risk of anything here, right? So genetically higher levels can also be associated with a decreased risk for Alzheimer's in men, right? Genetically, these genetic studies show that it's causal, but you can see here that my levels are lower, which is why this test comes up higher. So it's also important for mood. Low serum and plasma DHEA levels are associated with depression in some people. And so if somebody says, hey, I've got a bad mood, right? Or they're anxious or they have different kinds of issues. How do I know if that has to do with their DHEA, it has to do with their thyroid hormones, if that has to do with their iron levels, not enough protein, right? It could be related to a whole bunch of stuff. How do I know what the hell is going on if I don't see the lab tests? Or how do you know? You can't. That's why getting these lab tests are critical. So an amino acid panel can help people with low mood because certain amino acids like tryptophan, tyrosine, phenylalanine are precursors to serotonin, dopamine, norepinephrine. It turns out my DHEA, I think it was low because I didn't have enough sulfur. So if you actually look at DHEA itself, most of the DHEA in the body is stored as the sulfate. But you could see my DHEA levels are normal, but the DHEA sulfate is low. It turns out that I think that has to do with just not having enough sulfur in the body. And I'm pretty confident that now that I'm supplementing with MSM, my DHEA is going to go up. And if that turns out to be true, then that's very good information to know for anyone who has low DHEA. Is that due to just lower androgen production or is it due to not enough sulfur? And so you could see that my latest result, four out of my latest results had low DHEA levels. And I think that has to do with low sulfur. So let's see if that actually pans out in the blood. But I think it has to do with that. And the reason why it's lower now is because, and why it started to get lower here is because as I started exercising more, I placed more of a demand on sulfur in the body and it wasn't creating enough. It was being shunted into other purposes. So, you know, DHEA sulfate comes up pretty high for me, and it won't come up that high for many people. The reason why it comes up high is because it's quite important for me, and that's based on my blood test. So again, if you're on some kind of budget, you might not check for DHEA normally, but because it comes up high, and so the system is pretty smart.
This clip is from episode 12 with Matt Kiverlein. And it's titled Exploring Rapamycin, Longevity, and HealthSpan. In this episode, Dr. Matt Kiverlein and Joe explore the fascinating realm of rapamycin and its implications for longevity and healthspan. So they delve deep into the biological mechanisms underlying rapamycin's effects, the best way to take it, its impact on immune system processes, and the promising potential that it has.
Let's actually go into rapamycin because sure. I have my, it's basically the most researched drug or supplement or anything, the most researched substance for anti-aging. It has the most evidence behind it. Would you say that's true?
I think that's fair. So I don't know if it's been the most researched, but I would say certainly on the preclinical side, so if we're only talking about laboratory studies, rapamycin is without a doubt the gold standard for pharmacological intervention that affects longevity. And so differentiate dietary studies, because caloric restriction has been studied for decades, right? So there's much more data on caloric restriction and aging than for anything else. But once you get outside of the caloric restriction literature, and then you start looking at small molecules, supplements, pharmaceuticals, rapamycin certainly is the gold standard in the sense that it has the best data. So it's highly reproducible. It increases lifespan and seems to delay aging in every model system where it's been studied, from single-celled organisms like yeast all the way up to mice and rats. And it works starting in middle age. And actually, that's really important, because that's not true of everything. But with rapamycin, at least in mammals, mice and rats, you can actually start the treatment about the biological equivalent of a 60, 65-year-old person and still get most or all of the benefits. And this has been seen over and over again in multiple different laboratories, multiple different dosing regimens. And that's unique in the longevity field. There's a vast majority of studies where something looks really promising, and then somebody tries to reproduce it and it can't be reproduced, or the effect isn't quite as big as it originally seemed like it would be. Rapamycin has really stood the test of time over the last 20 years. And so I really feel like it's the thing that we can have the most confidence in, maybe outside of caloric restriction. We could actually talk about caloric restriction, because I would say there's even reason to believe that rapamycin is more consistent across different genetic backgrounds. I know you're a genetic guy with Salt to Code. So with caloric restriction, there's about one third of the genetic backgrounds, even in mice, where caloric restriction doesn't work or is even harmful. We haven't seen that with rapamycin, although to be fair, it hasn't been studied across as many different genetic backgrounds. But certainly from a small molecule drug perspective, it's the best in class right now for a longevity intervention.
Yeah, and that's really interesting. And I've read that before, what you mentioned, that it could work mostly if you start at middle age. And you said even potentially even all, meaning there would be no benefit to taking it earlier than later? Is that?
I think we don't know. So what I can say is it appears that you get most of the benefits starting later in life. One of the challenges with rapamycin is we still don't really know what the optimal dose is for longevity. We know from studies that have been done with the interventions testing program that we haven't yet hit the optimal dose, meaning they've gone up and up in dose and it keeps getting longer and longer for lifespan effects. But I don't think we know what the optimal dose is. And without knowing that, it's really hard to do a direct comparison, say starting at a young age versus an old age. But what I can say is at the same dose, starting in middle age gives you almost the same benefit, if not the same benefit, as starting at a young age.
Okay, that is very interesting. That means that if you're young, it doesn't make sense to take it. You might as well take it when you get older.
First of all, yeah, I think we have to be obviously careful about extrapolating directly from mice to humans, but it's certainly suggestive that if it works the same way in humans, that there would be relatively little additional benefit to starting at a young age. And obviously, the longer you're taking any drug, the more risk there's going to be of side effects, right, that might counteract the benefit. That's one of the really nice things about rapamycin, is it seems like you can start in middle age. And I was just going to say, even maybe more exciting than that, there's now multiple studies in mice showing that even short transient treatment periods can lead to pretty significant benefits. In mice, anywhere from 6 to 12 weeks of treatment, again, starting at about the mouse equivalent of 60, 65 years old, can have profound effects in multiple tissues and organs. So you can reverse functional declines in the heart, reverse periodontal disease in mice in 8 weeks, reverse immune dysfunction in 6 weeks, reverse cognitive decline in 10 weeks, reverse ovarian failure in I think 8 to 10 weeks. So it's really interesting that you can have these sort of apparent functional rejuvenations from rapamycin starting in middle age within a period of a couple of months. Now, the question is, does that work the same way in people? We don't know yet, but there's certainly, I think, accumulating evidence that it probably does on about the same time scale, at least for certain aspects of biological aging. You can actually see improvements in 6 to 12 weeks treatment with rapamycin in people in at least certain tissues and organs.
Why wouldn't more drug companies be researching this for different conditions like Alzheimer's, some of the conditions that you mentioned?
If you're
seeing some really promising stuff in animals, then why wouldn't?
So I think there's two reasons. So for rapamycin specifically, it's off patent. So there's really no financial incentive to go do the large clinical trials to demonstrate efficacy for other indications. There are other versions of rapamycin. There's a family of drugs called rapalogs, where there are patent life on some of these rapalogs, and there are companies looking at these rapalogs for a lot of different endpoints, but potentially health span related endpoints. But the other problem is, because rapamycin was first developed clinically for human use as an organ transplant drug, it got a bad reputation among clinicians and with FDA because it was used at high doses in people who were taking a lot of other drugs, and there were some side effects at those doses for sure. And so it's got a black box warning for that reason. And so there's a reputation problem with rapamycin and this class of drugs as a whole because of the way it was developed clinically. Now, that's starting to change. We're learning from people using rapamycin off-label that in otherwise pretty healthy people taking lower doses of the drug, you really don't see much in the way of side effects, but it takes a long time to change a reputation problem when a drug is labeled as a dangerous drug.
One of my concerns of taking rapamycin is the immunosuppression. The reason why I take it so infrequently is because basically if I'm traveling, I'm much more likely to get sick and infection. And so if I'm suppressing my immune system, that's probably not the great idea. So basically if I'm traveling, if it's the winter and I'm exposed to many people, which is the case currently, I have these reservations, or if I'm doing a lot of exercise and I'm suppressing my immune system in other ways, I then be like, do I want to take rapamycin now? And sure. Excuses not to take it. And the question is, I guess, like, how much do we know about taking the immune suppression effects and what that can cause in terms of, if we're studying this on mice in a cage, are people blowing on them and getting them sick? I don't know, right? How much, when I'm doing acro yoga, people are blowing on my face and it's very easy to get sick in that context. When we're doing these studies on mice, are they in cages and they're just not getting exposed to infections, or what's happening there?
So I think there's a few things to say there. First of all, that's a completely legitimate concern given what I talked about before, which is the reputation that rapamycin has as an immunosuppressant. I actually don't think that rapamycin by itself, particularly at the doses that people are using off-label, is a true immunosuppressant. It's an immunomodulator. So it changes the response of the immune system to different. So the couple of things we know about rapamycin in mice. During the chronic treatment phase, while the mice are getting the rapamycin, there seems to actually be a shift where the mice become more resistant to some pathogens and more sensitized to others. Again, that's at high doses. So does that mean anything in people? I don't know. But that's the observation. So it's not a general immunosuppressant.
Let's talk about the human equivalent dosage, because there's the dosage that people are taking it.
I'll get to the human data in just a second, but I just want to set the stage for what we know. The other thing we know in mice, so we know that with age, in both mice and people, the ability of the immune system to fight off pathogens declines, and the ability of the immune system to respond to a vaccine declines. In mice, 6 weeks of treatment with rapamycin, and then you stop the treatment, and then you give a vaccine, is enough to fully restore the aged immune system's ability to respond to a vaccine and fight off subsequent infections. So I think what we can say for sure in mice is that transient treatment with rapamycin, 6 weeks, rejuvenates the functional ability of the immune system to respond to vaccines and fight off infections over some period going forward. There's pretty good data in people, the same thing probably true. So two clinical trials were done with a derivative of rapamycin called everolimus that showed improved vaccine response in the elderly. These were healthy elder people, 6 weeks of treatment, and better ability to fight off a bunch of different types of infection over the next six to nine. It's at least consistent with the mouse data there. So I think that there is this rebound effect, maybe is one way to think about it, of the immune system from a short treatment with rapamycin. I think the question you're asking is, when you're taking rapamycin, is there an increased risk of infection? We don't have a lot of data. My guess is there is a slight increased risk in off-label use of rapamycin, and I'll get to the dose in just a second, I promise. We did a study recently, it was published last year in Geroscience, where we collected data from 333 people who'd been using rapamycin off-label, and we compared them to people who'd never used rapamycin. And there we didn't find any evidence for increased risk of bacterial infection, but at least statistically, so it wasn't statistically significant. There was a slight increase, it just didn't reach statistical significance. The only side effect that was more prevalent in rapamycin users was mouth sores. And that makes sense because that's the most common side effect seen in organ transplant patients. about 15% of people taking rapamycin off-label get canker sores. Basically, they aren't severe mouth sores at these doses, but they are like a typical canker sore. Okay, so the dosing here is complicated. It's all over the place, but the average, the median dose is 6 milligrams once a week. And so that's the most, that's also the most common dose that people are using off-label, but there's a wide variation on both sides of that. Some people are taking it daily. Some people are taking it once every 2 weeks. The majority of people are taking it 6 milligrams once a week. So I would say at that dose, the immunosuppressive effects for bacterial infections might be real, but they're relatively small. The response to viruses might actually be boosted by that dose of rapamycin. And I think there's a pretty good chance that a cyclic use of rapamycin for, say, 6 weeks or 12 weeks could boost immune function generally.
So let's get to some of the dosing that we're seeing in animal studies that are being used for longevity, trying to make them equivalent to humans, and what we're seeing the negative effects were in these black box, either black box warnings in the organ transplant, and just trying to compare all the dosing.
So I think obviously dosing is challenging to compare going from mice to humans. There are these sort of formulas that you can use based on body surface area and things like that. We can start there. And what we know from the studies in mice, so most of the studies in mice have dosed rapamycin in the food. It has to be in an enteric coating because rapamycin is insensitive or sensitive to gastric pH. So it has to get through the stomach to the small intestine. So in most of the time in mice, it's dosed in these microencapsulated formulation in the food at between 14 parts per million and 42 parts per million. Now, what does that mean in human doses? A couple things to say. One is humans are not taking rapamycin with their meals, right? Usually they're taking it as one pill a day. So the kinetics are fundamentally different in mice delivered this way versus humans. The doses, again, I'm really hesitant to say what that means, but I'd say the 42 part per million dose is probably comparable to, I don't know, 4 or 5 milligrams in a person. Maybe not that much, maybe 3 milligrams once a day. So that's what's different though. There aren't very many studies in mice where it's been dosed intermittently, like once a week. That's a thing that the human off-label use community has adopted without a lot of animal data to back it up, that you're going to get the longevity benefits. And the reasons for that adoption in the off-label use community are, I think, at least twofold. One is the studies that I alluded to earlier from, this is work that was done by Joan Manick looking at vaccine response. So they looked at 1 milligram a day, 5 milligrams a week, once a week, or 20 milligrams once a week. And what they found was that at the 5 milligrams once a week, they got the best efficacy in terms of vaccine response and the lowest side effects. In fact, no different from placebo at that dose. So I think that was one piece of evidence that suggested once weekly dosing in humans could at least give the immune benefits. And then Alan Green, who was the first physician to really go public and advocate for off-label use of rapamycin, settled on 6 milligrams once a week as his recommended dose. I think, again, based at least in part off of Jones' paper. And so the first few hundred people who started using rapamycin off-label, I think, just started using that dose. And so is it the most efficacious dose? Nobody really knows, right? We tried to get towards that in this study that we did, but we just didn't have enough data for people taking much different doses to really be able to say with any confidence, are there differences? So it's just a lack of data to have any strong conclusions about, is that the sweet spot? Are we too low? Are we too high? Would once every 2 weeks be better? Would daily be better? I think we just don't know. My speculation is that when you go to the daily dosing, you start to uncover some of the side effects that are seen in organ transplant patients. And this is speculation. I don't have a lot of data to support it, but it's my intuition or my speculation that you're probably going to have a slightly higher risk of bacterial infections. You might also start to see a higher prevalence of some of the metabolic side effects. So things like lipid dysregulation and glucose dysregulation. So there's this thing called pseudodiabetes that happens sometimes when people are taking high doses of rapamycin, where they can have impaired insulin sensitivity. No evidence for that at the once weekly dosing that I know of, but I think my guess is if you started going to daily 2-3 mgs a day, you would start to see those more prevalent. Also, my speculation is you would also start to see better efficacy for things like autoimmune disorders at those daily dosing. And this is anecdotal, but it comes from talking to a lot of people. I know of several people who have autoimmune disorders who have greatly improved their quality of life taking rapamycin off label. And my impression is usually those people have better success if they're doing like 1 milligram a day or 2 milligrams a day, mm-hmm. as opposed to 6 milligrams a week. But unfortunately, that's my gut feeling, or that's what I think, but I can't say with any confidence because nobody's done clinical trials.
That's really interesting. I think like when I experiment with the 2-3 milligrams rapamycin, what I notice is that it actually counteracts food sensitivities to a certain degree.
Yeah, which makes sense. Yeah.
I think when I look at the research for food sensitivities and food allergies, it's an intolerance, right? And that's the same. It's similar to organ transplant. Your body is not recognizing. Your body's recognizing something that's foreign.
Exactly. Yeah, that's what I was going to say. Not every food sensitivity is due to sterile inflammation, but I think a lot of food sensitivities are. In other words, there's something in the food your body is recognizing as foreign, and you're getting an inflammatory response. And that is exactly what rapamycin is most potent at knocking down. I wish I understood the mechanisms. I wish I was an immunologist, but I don't really. But I wish I knew more about immunology. I've tried. But it's been my observation that with age, we see an increase in sterile inflammation in at least every mammal that's been studied. And rapamycin, for reasons I don't completely understand, is very potent at knocking down that sterile inflammation. So it makes perfect sense to me that food sensitivities that are inflammatory induced, would tend to be responsive to rapamycin. So I think that's extremely plausible.
This clip is from the last episode of the season, episode 13, and it's titled Master the Three Pillars of Immune Health. So this is another solo podcast that Joe did. And in it, he'll give you an in-depth overview of the three main components of the immune system, teaching you how to identify when they're compromised and giving you insights on how to support them to prepare your body for illnesses.
Mitochondria is very important for immunity because the immune system takes up a lot of energy. And when your mitochondria are strong or they're well functioning, then your body has a signal that it can basically use food that you take in and convert it into energy, into ATP. And then when you have enough ATP and energy, it can use that to create all kinds of different immune responses. And so when your body senses that your mitochondria are weak, it has to use these kind of backup systems that are way more damaging. Whereas if your mitochondria are strong, it can use the resources, the energy that you have to work quite effectively at improving the immune system. So how do you tell if your mitochondria is strong? There's a couple ways. One of the most simple ways to tell if you have good mitochondria or not is, do you feel tired all the time? Or do you get tired in the afternoon? Or do you get tired often? Fatigue could be a sign of, for example, iron deficiency, which is probably connected to the mitochondria. But mitochondria, if your mitochondria are producing a lot of energy, then you should feel awake. Basically, the hypothalamus is what determines if you're fatigued or not. The hypothalamus senses how much energy you have in the body via the mitochondria. And if your mitochondria are not producing these energy-related molecules, then your hypothalamus is going to tell your body to be tired, essentially. And so that's why how tired you are is one good example of how good your mitochondria is. Another is if you get sick often. When your body produces a lot of energy, it has a lot of spare capacity to produce various aspects of the immune system that can help prevent you getting sick. And so that's another way to tell if your mitochondria is poor. So if you're sick a lot, when you do get sick, you get immobilized. And again, if you're sick, if you're producing enough energy, you probably won't feel the fatigue from combating an infection. Whereas if you're not producing enough energy in the system, then when you get sick and your body's producing a lot of stuff for the immune system, all of a sudden that energy is being used up and you get tired and you feel like you need to go to sleep. You need to go to sleep early. You need to sleep more. And because your body is trying to get into hibernation mode. So how do you know if your mitochondria are not working well? Number one is how often you get sick. How do you feel when you get sick? If you're just completely immobilized and tired and you need to sleep all day, that's also a sign that you don't have enough spare capacity of energy-related molecules. And again, how often you're tired. So if your mitochondria are working very well, you shouldn't get that afternoon dip. You're more likely to get that afternoon dip as you get older because the mitochondria gets worse as you get older. There's certain genetic predispositions that you could look out, specific genes like SOD2 and SOD3. These are some examples of genes that could be related to mitochondrial function and oxidative stress. One thing that's really important for mitochondria is the B vitamins. So pretty much all the B vitamins, and it depends on individuals which B vitamins they need more of. In my case, I needed almost all of them. So B1 is important for mitochondria, also known as thymine. B2 is important for mitochondria. And so, for example, if you have an MTHFR variation, you're going to need more B2. If you, for example, are stressed a lot, you're going to need more B1. And for example, people who are stressed a lot can often feel tired. Number one, when you're stressed, you use a lot of energy, right? And you're also using up a lot of B vitamins. And so anything that uses up a lot of B vitamins is going to slow the mitochondria down. And so you could take extra B vitamins, but as I was saying, in my case, niacin was the most important B vitamin for me in terms of mitochondria. My mitochondria, for some reason, need a lot of niacin. Now, it is known that niacin is very important for mitochondrial function. I did take a test for mitochondrial function, and it turned out that it was about the same time where I figured out that I needed more niacin from other tests and just from my own experiments. I realized, hey, wait a second, I also had this mitochondria test that showed me I needed more niacin. Now, your mitochondria could be different in different ways. My mitochondria seemed to be very strong in the muscles, which is why even though I didn't have the best mitochondria, my VO2 max was very good because that was testing my mitochondria in my muscles. Now, the mitochondrial test that I took was testing the mitochondria in my immune cells. And so this is something that I figured. I didn't realize there was that difference, meaning you could have great mitochondria in your muscles, and I'm strong and I have a lot of muscles. But on the other hand, you could have poor mitochondria in the immune cells. And so my mitochondria is good in my muscle cells and it's poor in the immune cells, in which case I could look very muscular but be tired. Now, I've been working on my mitochondria for a while, and so my mitochondria got way better, but there were certain ingredients that when you improve your mitochondria, you also need more raw materials, and mainly in the form of these B vitamins like niacin, B1. And so that's what I realized is that as I was stressing my body more, I actually needed more of these mitochondrial coenzyme like the niacin in order to make them work well in the immune system. So some of the main supplements for mitochondrial function are niacin. There's some herbals as well. And there's B complex. I would say that B complex is number one, right? And I have this friend that always gets sick. He was getting sick like once a month for his whole life. And I said, look, I gave him a couple supplements, one, very few actually. And one of the main ones I told him is, look, you need a B complex, right? So if you're getting sick often or if your mitochondria are not good, you need a very good quality B complex. And that's the coenzymated forms of these B vitamins. And that's like a starting point. And you also probably need to take niacin separately because these B vitamins don't have enough niacin in them because there's negatives if you take high dose niacin. So they try to be conservative. And so you need a B complex, you need niacin. I think these are the two main supplements for mitochondrial complex. Again, all the B vitamins are very important for mitochondrial function. My favorite mitochondrial herbal supplements are Gynostemma, Eleuthero, and Schizandra. Another important thing for the mitochondria is reactive oxygen species. So your body uses these reactive oxygen species to kill off infections. Now, you want there to be a balance. If you have too high levels of these reactive oxygen species, also known as oxidative stress in general, then it can actually weaken your mitochondria. So really what you want to do is you want to have very strong mitochondria so that if you have some oxidative stress, you'll be able to combat it. It's not going to make a big difference. On the other hand, you also want to increase oxidative stress. And you do that with things like exercise, with things like sun, with things like, it's mainly exercise and sun, to be honest. Those are the two biggest increasers of oxidative stress in the body. You could also do breathing exercises as well. But sun, for example, will give you a very strong burst of nitric oxide. And same with exercise. And so these are two of the main ways to increase the level of oxidative stress. Yet on the other hand, you want to have very good mitochondria, and then you don't want to have too much of this oxidative stress, which is why there's a curve, a U-shaped curve, whereas
a certain amount of exercise is great. If you have too much exercise, then you're going to need to take more antioxidants to make sure that's not out of balance. Again, when you have too much exercise, that can weaken the body, weaken the immune system. It could, by causing inflammation, by causing oxidative stress. But if your mitochondria are good enough, they could often handle this extra load on the body.
67% of listeners aren't following the show, so please don't forget to show your support by hitting the follow button now. You'll not only be supporting the show, but also investing in yourself and your health journey, all while helping to keep us ad-free.